Hey guys, and welcome to the Pacing Racing Podcast, the Canadian triathlon podcast made in mind for the age group triathletes. Now today, Jenna, Sarah, and I have an awesome new episode today where we teamed up with Andrew and Mike from the Endurance Innovation Podcast to go over a special episode as we gear up for Kona 2020. Now, as many of you have already heard from previous episodes, Jenna Sarah is actually coming up to her Kona debut this year after a first place age group finish at Ironman Cork. So we thought it'd be an awesome episode to have a podcast. We talk about things like race specificity in training, heat adaptation, and on-course heat management, and what's changed over the years in training for an Ironman. So we also dive into nutrition and hydration strategies and how bike positioning and aerodynamic testing through the virtual wind tunnel makes a huge difference in your speed and efficiency on the bike. Now, this was our first four-person podcast episode, and it was an absolute blast. I'm happy to share this with you guys because there's some great concepts and great perspectives from multiple angles in this episode, and we make sure we did our best to make sure it was done in a clear and concise manner. So I hope you guys all enjoy this podcast, and now let's cue the music. First sponsor of today's show is Soul Fitness Canada, who is a premier global name in the fitness industry and has become one of the fastest growing fitness brands across the US and Canada. And the reason why I'm so excited for Soul Fitness Canada to be the show sponsor is because all of you know, we are unfortunately nearing the end of summer, which means as a proactive thinker, I have to start thinking about indoor training. And with Challenge Roth just under 11 months away, we're ramping up the volume and running, which requires a treadmill that I'll be able to spend countless hours on. So with lots of research, I found a brand that I can stand behind for their value, quality, and their service. And I'm excited to say that I ended up actually getting the TT8 treadmill from Soul Fitness Canada. And so you'll definitely be seeing lots of this treadmill, guys, in the Pacing Racing videos. And I can't wait to put some miles on inside the paint cave. And now you may ask, how did I end up choosing Soul Fitness Canada over all the other brands? So for those who don't know, Soul has a full line of treadmills, ellipticals, and exercise bikes, and has been in the industry for decades and is a popular brand well over 29 countries. They are one of the only manufacturers to warehouse all their parts and products in Canada and host a fully bilingual customer service team. And to briefly touch on the treadmill I went with, it offers up to 15 levels of incline, 6 levels of decline with speeds up to 12 miles per hour. It has accurate heart rate monitoring with both pulse grips and chest strap options. And the TT8 features a large 22-inch by 60-inch running surface, inboard speakers, and a cooling fan, and so much more, guys. So these are all important factors for me when I went looking for a treadmill. And another thing that may resonate with the listeners is it's not just for winter training. In fact, I have a daughter that's 19 months old and who happens to love her nap time. So I love the idea that I'm able to go for a long run on the treadmill while she sleeps. And I think this is a great way for effective time management for the time crunch triathletes out there. So if any of you are in the market for treadmills, bikes, rowers, or ellipticals, or any of that stuff for your pain cave, then head to soulfitness.ca/pacing-and-racing. And again, Soul is spelled S-O-L-E. If you guys have any questions on products, then you definitely shoot me a DM and I can help guide you into a treadmill that would suit your needs. So Soul Fitness is providing Pacing Racing listeners a free equipment mat with any cardio equipment they purchase from the website, which is a $50 value. So that's super cool of them, guys. And all you have to do is type in Pacing and Racing during checkout. The second sponsor of today's podcast is Sycon Bags, which I'm super thrilled about because, of course, being here in Canada, unfortunately, it requires a ton of traveling and flying to get around to some of these big named races. So Sycon has actually offered up a 30% discount to the Pacing and Racing listeners, and you can reap benefits of this by using the promo code Pacing and Racing at checkout for 30% off. So if anyone has actually traveled with a bike before, you may know that it's an extremely hectic journey if you aren't prepared. And not only that, but it's a whole process of taking your bike apart and putting it back together when you get there. Meanwhile, on this flight, you're praying that your bike doesn't get damaged. So, I mean, that's why I'm thrilled to say after a ton and ton of research into this bike cases, they finally went with the Sycon Aerotech Evolution X, and I cannot wait to show you guys. So I'll be doing a video going over in detail exactly how easy it is to store my bike in it to travel, how little time it takes, and most importantly, how convenient it is to travel with. And so now many of my listeners who follow me know I'm a big fan of keeping costs low because we all know triathlon is just such an expensive sport, but I truly think a bike case is just one of those few items that you should definitely not cheap out on, guys. And the reason why I say this is because there'd be no worse feeling than traveling to a race only to get there with a damaged bike or even dealing with the stress of rebuilding your bike. So for a few quick points on the bike case that I chose, it's one of the toughest and lightest hard shell cases in the world, yet it only comes in at a very light 26 pounds. and it can fit bikes up to 62 centimeters in size and wheels up to 26 inches. And with smaller bikes like mine, they can actually fit without removing the saddle. And in most cases, you only need to actually remove the wheels, remove one pedal, and turn the handlebars. That's it. And of course, I could talk up the bike case I bought, but there's just so many more Cycon bags available that they all have their own neat perks and bonuses. So, I mean, definitely feel free to browse around, see which one best suits you and your needs. And if you want to check all these out, guys, you can check them out and see what's on sale by heading to www.cyconbags.com or search them on Instagram, Facebook, or YouTube by typing in Cycon, which again is spelled S-C-I-C-O-N. Okay, so I'm excited to say that we're here with the Endurance Innovation Podcast crew. So, Mike and Andrew, welcome to Pace Racing Podcast. How's things going, guys?
Good. Thanks a lot for having us.
Yeah, thanks very much, Stephen. Everything's great here, too.
Yeah, it's our pleasure. We're pretty happy to talk to you guys this week. Personally, I've been listening actually to your guys' podcast, especially about the heat adaptation episodes. Going to Kona, that has been absolutely my focus. And as you know as well, both myself and Steven have done the virtual wind tunnel testing through previously Stack Performance and now 4Eyes. So we're excited to dive into that as well.
Yeah, definitely lots to talk about. And on the previous take of this, before we had the connection issues, I know Michael was saying, cut us off if we start to go off on a tangent, because that tends to happen.
All yeah, good. when you get Andrew and I talking about heat transfer or fluid dynamics, then we sort of get, you know, we get lost in our own world and time stands still. And, you know, it's one of those moments.
Awesome. Well, hey, that's amazing. That'll be good for us to kind of listen in and get your insight on it all. So we're super pumped for that. But before we dive into all that, I guess, let's go over some intros here for each of you. If you don't mind sharing a little bit about your triathlon backgrounds, just sort of how you ended up coming together ultimately to create the Endurance Innovation Podcast that you guys work on together.
Andrew, do you want to start?
Sure, why not? So about myself, I got into triathlon maybe 5 or 6 years ago, and it was kind of an interesting transition because I'd actually been doing a lot of weightlifting. I wasn't powerlifting or doing any competitions, but I'd put on a fair amount of muscle mass and maybe a little bit more fat bulk than I should have. But it was tough when I started running at like almost a 200-pound weight, and then I've gone down probably 30 or 40 pounds since then. But yeah, it's amazing to see the difference over the past couple of years. Yeah, got racing. I really enjoyed it. And then with a friend of mine, Art Hare, we started our entrepreneurial experiences, adventures with Stack, and we had our trainer and we made the virtual wind tunnel, and that turned into a business. And eventually we got noticed by some other people, and, things transitioned onto 4Eyes, and, you know, the rest is history as far as the career goes. With Michael and myself, I think it was actually the virtual wind tunnel that connected us in the first
place.
That's
right. It was, we had a mutual a connection through Cody Beals, and a friend of Cody's introduced him to me. And at the time I was operating a cycling studio in Toronto, and he came in to do a talk and did a run with us. And during that run, he and I got chatting, and he was talking about this, you know, cool new technology that he was trying out, the virtual wind tunnel from this Waterloo startup. And, you know, that sort of that really piqued my interest. And I asked him all sorts of questions, and then got in touch with Andrew, and they came by the studio. And I think me and some of the folks I was working with at the time, we were, I think, some of the first, at least, age groupers that they ran the tests on.
Huh, that's incredible. And it's actually really cool to kind of see this all go full circle, because both you guys put both myself and Jenna through the virtual wind tunnel analysis as well. And at the time, I don't think any of us really knew each other. So I think just how that all kind of worked out the way it did. And then to do this podcast today, it's a pretty cool full circle type of situation all around the virtual wind tunnel. So I'm super pumped about that. So awesome, guys.
Computational fluid dynamics bringing people together.
Look at that, eh?
It always does.
Awesome, guys. So we have lots to talk about today. And before we do, seeing as, you know, Kona's just around the corner, traditionally, Jen and I have done pre-race predictions sort of at the end of our podcast, but I think it'd be an excellent start for each of us all to go over our pre-race predictions, or basically who will take the crowns at Kona this year.
Yeah, definitely. So let's start with you guys, Mike and Andrew, get your insight. For the men's side, who do you think has the win? Let's start off with Andrew.
All right. So that's a good question. I think what I'd prefer to do is pick the top three because I don't want to stick my neck out too far.
Fair enough.
I think the Germans are definitely going to be in there. So Ferdino, Kienle, and Lange. So all of those guys, I would be surprised if all of them end up in the top three. I think they're all contenders for the win, or at least the top three. But for all of them to have the races come together such that they end up on the podium, I think that might be a little tough. I would be really interested to see if someone like McNamee or Braden Curry comes in, because I think they've got the potential just kind of on the outside edge of the podium right now to come through with this breakthrough performance. And a lot of it, I think, will come down to conditions. So if it's hot, mm-hmm. someone like Lange, if it's a less hot day, it might favor someone else like Braden Curry, who's a bit more of a powerhouse, but I think may not react as well to the heat.
Well, and it's funny, no one seems to talk much about David McNamee, but he's been in third place the last 2 years with some wicked run splits. Like, it'll be interesting to see what changes he's made this year to see if he could actually contend for a higher spot on the podium.
Yeah, he's just kind of waiting there to surprise someone, I think.
There we go. Very cool. And then, Mike, who do you think's got it this year?
I'd really like to see Ferdino take it back.
Yeah.
I think he is, you know, kind of not a very, maybe not a surprising pick by any stretch, but he hasn't been, you know, he hasn't had the races the last couple. And so this might be his year if he's back to form, and he certainly looks like he is. It'll be tough to beat Lange on the run with what he's capable of doing off the bike. Mm-hmm. I've also I like what Cam Wurf is doing. I just think that maybe this, you know, this big performance he just had in Italy was perhaps a little bit too close to the race.
Yeah.
To Kona to fully recover, but you never know. Like, that's honestly with with all athletes, elites and age group, the ability to recover from a big effort like that is always a little bit of a question mark. And if he can come back and you know, use that fitness, I think he could be a top three contender. But if not, then obviously that won't be something for him.
And that's if anyone who's listening doesn't know, Cam Wurf, he just went out and did an Ironman here in a record-breaking time with like a 2:45 run, which is, he's known as an Uber biker, but that was a wicked run split in there. So it sounds like he trains a lot more like a cyclist and works with a cycling coach as well. Just before, I guess the mentality used to always be you'd have to do well at the Vuelta like 3 weeks before the Tour de France to actually have a shot at winning the Tour. That's changed a little bit now, but he seems to have that same mentality, just kind of racing to top off the fitness and then go in for the big goal a few weeks later. So it'll be interesting to see if he can turn around and recover from that, because a marathon's a little different than a cycling tour.
Yeah, for sure. And he's the guy with the Kona bike record, right?
Oh, so yeah. Yeah, like 409.
He's proven that he can ride. And his swim in Italy was superb too. So I don't think he's going to be, you know, off the mark out of the water either.
Definitely. Oh, it's going to be so good. Stephen, how about you? Who do you think has it this year?
Yeah, you know what? I'm sort of leaning towards with what Mike was saying there. So I was going to say Cam Wurf. The only other thing I was thinking about, again, what he just mentioned there, was the Ironman Italy that he just raced in. It might be a little bit too soon to have a good performance in Kona, but I'm just thinking with that new run split he's capable of doing after the bike. I know he can recover well after those long bike rides, and I think that's why he's new to a racer doing just so many races in a given year. But yeah, who knows, pushing that hard of a marathon that close. But he's my pick I'm going to go with. And then also I'm going to be hopeful and I'm going to wish Cody Beals.
Yeah.
I know it's going to be his Kona debut, right? So whether it's going to happen or not, I mean, at least top five, I think I'd be thrilled to see something like that happen. So I think that was my pick.
I was actually going to put him in as my dark horse as well, because I think he's like his Tremblant Blanc performance, man. I think that was an eye opener for a lot of people. We've been following Cody because he's kind of the local guy, and we've been working with him. But for a lot of people, that was where, you know, setting the course record and like a 2:42 marathon on a pretty tough course. So that, I think that put him on the world stage for a
while. And Cody's good in the heat too.
Absolutely.
Sure. He's always done well in hot races. And I know he's prepping for this one He's obviously coached by David Tilbury Davis, and David and I had a recent conversation about adaptation, heat adaptation, leading up to Kona. So I think I'm sure he's putting Cody through his paces for that as well.
So, fun story on heat adaptation. I was actually at Ironman Chattanooga with Cody. And because they canceled the swim for that race, I was shoving ice down his tri-suit while he was warming up before the race. So he won that race. But I don't want to claim responsibility.
Just saying.
But in all seriousness, though, he said, like, yeah, having the ice beforehand helped him. He basically explained it as like a bubble of coolness around him for the first 20, 30 minutes of the ride, and he could push that extra bit harder.
Wow.
That's really
amazing.
Interesting. Yeah.
Very cool. So, I mean, I think we're all on board then. We're hoping that Cody would be the dark horse in that situation. So perfect. And I mean, I guess, Jenna, let's, what are your picks, I guess, for the male? And then actually, if you want to start off with the females as well, too.
Yeah, definitely. So, you know what? It's hard for me to go past Jan Frodeno. He just, you know what? He's one of the greatest in there. And if he is fit and ready to fight, I think it was smart of him to skip 70.3 Worlds this year and just kind of focus entirely on Kona. And it just shows he wants it. And it's really, yeah, it's really hard to go past him for me. It's really interesting to see what the conditions do this year. I think that's going to make the huge difference in something, whether you have like a Patrick Lange being able to stick with the bike groups. If it is a really tough, windy day, then someone like Cameron Worf definitely has an advantage and can make up a lot of time on that bike course. So, you know, it'll just be interesting to see how the race dynamics come together. And I think the interesting thing this year is there's a lot of players who are kind of new to the race who can have a huge effect on the race, but may not be able to win it yet, or may, you know, not even reach the podium. But it'll be interesting to see how those dynamics come together for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, no,
I think Jan's got it if he's healthy and ready to go.
Perfect. And then what about the women's side? What do you think is going to happen on there?
Man, I think we're all going to have the same response here.
It's hard not to, I think.
We almost should have done like second and third place
second,
in here.
Yeah,
yeah, definitely. Danielle Reif is just such a machine. It's incredible. I think what's a little different this year is the women are starting to believe that they can actually contend with her. I think in past years, it's been more of a race for second place, but now you have people like Jocelyn McCauley, who we had on the podcast before, who said, no, like, I'm out there to try to push her and make this hurt. And obviously, you have a couple other people who are really starting to step it up, like Lucy Charles as well, saying, no, we're going to make her fight for this. So I think the mentality is changing a little bit, and I hope we see something interesting in the race come of that, because, you know what, she is just so dominant, and it is so incredible to watch her actually race out there. But yeah, I hope a couple of the women make it hard for her.
Oh, yeah. Perfect. Excellent. And then so I guess, Mike, what would be your picks for the women's side? I mean, going for second place, third place.
Yeah, probably. I think, look, it's been hard to beat Daniela, and it's one of those cases where, you know, it's until we see some chinks in that armor, it's going to be hard to say she's not going to be on top of that podium. I think Lucy Charles is still as strong as she was last year and does fairly well in the heat. I think she's definitely on that podium. I don't know who would round that out. I, you know, admittedly haven't been following the pro field as closely as I should have been. But certainly, you know, as far as a top spot, unless something dramatic happens, I think Daniela still has the, you know, the Vegas odds on that one.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. No, perfect. And Andrew, I guess, the same thing for you, or what are your thoughts on it?
Yeah. So, I think Daniela's got a good chance of winning. I think that's a fairly safe statement, but, I would love to see someone like Anna Haug come in and like on the run. Cause I think she had the fastest run split last year. I think she's like a former ITU athlete, so a really strong swimmer. So I don't think she can hang on to the feet of Lucy Charles and Lauren Brandon for the swim, but if she could get out there and kind of work with them on the bike, I think the three of them kind of teaming up would be a really strong contender for victory for one of them. Lauren, who we've worked with in the past, like she's fantastic, but I don't know that her run's quite there. So I think it would come down to whether or not Lucy or Anna could take Daniela off the podium there, or off the top spot of the podium anyway. But I think ultimately it's probably going to be Daniela again.
Perfect. Yeah, no. So I think it's a general consensus. That's what we're going to go with. I'm the same way. I'm thinking Daniela for the win. My dark horse in this situation. I mean, of course, Lucy Charles is up there too, but I'm going to be one to say Laura Phillip. I think that's another potential. I know she came off a pretty substantial injury, I guess, throughout the year. So she hasn't been able to perform or to show her performance, but going to assume if she's doing it and everything is all well, then I'd like to see her at least fighting for top five. So that's kind of how I'm going to end off that prediction on there. So awesome, guys. So I think we have our prediction there for the pros and that's all in the bag. So, I mean, let's sort of get into the meat and potatoes of this podcast and we'll talk about the training for Kona. And actually let's dive into, start off with race specificity because Jenna, actually start with you, Jenna. How have you been able to tailor your training and stuff to meet the demands of Kona? How's that all been going?
It's been going good. So obviously, Kona, the biggest challenge there is the heat. But at the end of the day, to even be able to contend with the heat and think about it, you have to be fit to race an Ironman. So I haven't been doing anything specific for like the Kona course. It's nothing too crazy in there outside of the possible conditions, but the elevation, everything like that isn't too insane. So really my biggest focus has just been getting as fit as possible for this race. I took a little downtime after Ironman Cork and started building up the last little while with, well, one little training race in there. But obviously, when it comes to actual race day, the heat is the biggest consideration. So I've actually been working a lot in an infrared sauna to try to get some kind of heat adaptation going for Kona because it hasn't been the warmest summer here in Calgary. We've had a little bit of a more wet, cooler summer this year. So unfortunately, I haven't been able to get any really scorching hot training days in there. So I'm spending a lot of time in the sauna for a couple reasons. One is the actual physical adaptation to it. So starting to sweat a little bit sooner, hoping to produce a few more red blood cells to help just transport that blood flow and cooling my skin. But also the mental side of it, I think, is a big thing that can often be overlooked in the heat. My coach and I talk a lot about kind of the central governor and how your body, you know, wants to shut down, like we saw a few times with Sarah True this year. Her body kind of shutting down in some of these races, that being able to push that central governor and push the amount of time that I can kind of handle being in the heat has been a big thing for us as well. Kind of teaching my body to go from freaking out, oh my God, it's so hot in here, I can't stay in here another second, and almost relaxing into that discomfort and trying to teach my body that it's okay and we can kind of push it a little bit further. So it's been kind of half physical and half mental training with the heat adaptation in the sauna. But that's kind of been the biggest thing going to Kona, just figuring out how to deal with the heat.
That sounds great. I think that a lot of what Amazing. You say resonates yeah. with what Andrew and I have talked about. And I like your notes on the psychological side of things. There's some good research that psychology mm-hmm. plays a very large role in heat tolerance. There've been some really neat studies that people have done to show that when participants think that it is hotter or they feel that it is hotter, they perform less well. So to your point of becoming mentally mm-hmm. adapted to it, there's a lot of value in doing that.
Yeah. And it's been interesting myself, just kind of playing around, obviously an experiment of one, but I noticed the first couple times I went into the sauna, it was like I started having a little bit of anxiety just even after 15 minutes in there, like when I was in the big steam room at the gym, like what happens if this door doesn't open? Because I'm reaching that point of like, I need to get out of here this second. And the anxiety would almost start to ratchet my heart rate up even higher, more so than what the heat was doing. And I've done some playing around with just even not really meditation, but just kind of trying to relax into a little bit more. And I've learned that I can actually lower my heart rate in there by just trying to calm down and relax into the discomfort, and learning that, yeah, a huge part of it is the psychological side as well.
Cool. Are you doing anything in terms of, are you changing pacing strategies for the heat, and are you changing hydration or nutrition at all?
Yeah. So with hydration and nutrition, I have an idea of a plan, but I do a lot of it on feel. I know likely I'll have to potentially reduce the amount of calories that I'm taking in just because my body is working so hard to cool my core. But for the most part, I play that off feel anyways. So it'll just be kind of being a little bit more attentive there. I will take on a bit more electrolytes, but to be honest, from kind of the testing I've done and training in ridiculous temperatures in Texas for a few years, I think people almost overestimate how many electrolytes they need in your body if you're kind of eating salt day to day. So I will take some more on board, but it's not going to be an insane amount. On pacing for the bike, it's not going to change a ton. Again, a lot of it's going to be by feel, but when I was racing an Ironman Cork, it was over 6 hours on the bike just because the condition, or just because the course and the conditions. In Kona, I'm expecting to be 30 to 40 minutes faster. So I think it'll be fairly similar race watts in there just because I'm going to be out for a much shorter time. And then when it comes to the run, again, I'm pretty based on feel. So going to kind of take it a little bit easier in the beginning, see how the body feels in the heat and temperatures, and just be dumping a lot of ice down my sports bra and kit the whole time to try to stay a little bit cooler.
that's good. That's funny. So actually, as you just touched on that, like using ice as a perfect example in the race, and I guess this could be an open question for anyone here, but just looking at some other ways that, you know, age groupers in general going to a hot race out there that they might not have expected, what are some sort of, if they haven't had time to adapt to the heat because it was sort of unexpected, perfect example, if you look at Frankfurt, I don't know if they were expecting that so much, but it was pretty hot there that day. Do you guys have any tips that age groupers could take as far as like heat management on course? Is things like ice, anything else that comes to mind for you guys?
Yeah, absolutely. We've talked about this a little bit on our episode and also on our chat with Alan Hovda. Ice is one of the best ways to cool yourself. Really, so I'll try to keep the nerddom to a minimum, but anytime you have water, which is the, you know, kind of what we all use to keep cool, change phase, and that is either melting ice or evaporating liquid water, that's really when you're getting a lot of that bang for your buck as far as cooling. So you can get a lot of cooling from from those phase changes. And so one of the tricky things in Kona is the humidity. Mm-hmm. So the problem with the humidity is since the air is so humid, that means it has a lot of moisture in the air already. And so that evaporative cooling, that cooling that comes from the water evaporating off your skin and most importantly off your kit, is not nearly as efficient because the air just can't hold any more moisture. So the mechanism by which humans generally are very good at cooling ourselves is blunted by that humidity. So that's still obviously going to be happening, but it's not as effective, which means that really the best way to go is to use ice as much as possible. So when using ice, and I'm kind of stealing Andrew's thunder because he's having some technical difficulties, but if he's listening, maybe he can flesh my story out a little bit. But generally when using ice, you want it to melt as much like inside your body as possible. So best case scenario is to actually eat it. So if there's any opportunity to consume slushy drinks, and they've done really good testing on athletes in hot conditions who've had a slushy drink before starting an event, just to pre-cool their core a little bit. So that's very effective. Ice in your mouth, absolutely useful. Ice down your kit, as Jenna was mentioning, that's also not a bad way to go. Mind you, some of that heat is going to be lost to the outside as opposed to, you know, to you. And one thing that Alan mentioned, he was racing in Norseman, which was atypically hot this year. He was holding onto ice cubes in his hands during the run. And because you can kind of close if you can imagine holding an ice cube, you can close your fingers around that ice cube. And as it melts, pretty much all of that cooling energy, if you like, is going into your, you know, into your fingers and into your body. So that is also an effective way to do it. Well, Andrew, anything else you want to add?
Well, I have no idea what was just said because I disappeared there for the last 5 minutes.
Just talking about how you can use ice in races and different cooling different ways to cool your body, especially when you're dealing with the humid conditions of Kona, who's talking a lot about ice, kind of the best ways to ingest it. And then other than that, just kind of being close to your body.
Yeah. So what your body naturally does when you overheat is, and you kind of alluded this to this before, but it redirects a lot of the blood flow to highly vascularized regions. So that's basically transferring all the heat from your core out to the surface, where evaporation and convection can take it away from your body and keep you cool. So the biggest challenge with Kona is the fact that it is so humid there. So when you sweat in a place like Arizona, that sweat is gone almost immediately. And that's a good thing, because it means it's evaporating. And the evaporation, like the phase change, this is why you get burned on steam essentially, but the phase change contains a lot of energy. So evaporation is one of the most efficient ways to take that heat away from you. When you're in Kona, there is so much humidity in the air already that you can't really evaporate that much more. So you're sweating, your body's trying to cope with how it knows how to cope, but it's just not really evolved for those conditions as much. So the sweat side of things, unfortunately, your body's kind of working against you in that scenario. So really, if you can drink something cold, that's one of the best things you can do. Pouring water over yourself is good as well. But really, if you could take in a slushy drink, that would be my number one recommendation for lowering your core body temperature. So I did a quick calculation at one point, but basically the challenge would be taking in a 1 liter slushy, but if you could take in a 1 liter slushy,
brain freeze.
That would be debilitating brain freeze, like ambulance level brain freeze. But that would be enough to lower your core body temperature on average by about 1.5 degrees. Like a crazy, crazy amount. So if you're overheating, like the start of heat stroke is around 40.5 degrees, or at least that's well into heat stroke actually. But if you were to take that that mega brain freeze ice slushy, then that would drop your core body temperature, given enough time, it would drop your core body temperature back down to a much safer like 38, 39. That would bring you right in line with where you want to be. And it's one of the fastest ways to do it.
Yeah, it looks like they're doing some playing around with that at the Tokyo test event for the Olympics for triathlon. Just trying to get some of those colder drinks on board kind of before and during with the coaches handing them off.
Yep. Yeah. And it's a great way to cool yourself before the race as well. And even you can overheat in the swim. So like that's something, basically you're starting off from a zero point. So whether you start with a like slightly chilled core body temperature or whether you start from a normal body temperature, like it'll just continue to increase throughout the day.
That's
so
a good point.
Honestly, even if you, you know, you don't really feel like it in the morning, it might not be a bad idea to try and take in some cool drinks and just kind of artificially lower your body temperature before you start out.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
Yeah, being proactive with this stuff is really important. As Andrew mentioned, it's you know it's going to become a problem at some point in time, and it's not as if when you're at Kona, you're never going to be a risk of, you know, of like hypothermia. So you might as well get an early start. And it's kind of like with, you know, nutrition, hydration, you know, you want to start that plan before you think you need to start that plan. Same goes with this management, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
That's actually, it's really fascinating to see that. And actually it's funny because now I'm looking back to races in the past and they've had slushies there. And I just thought that was like snow cones, sorry. And I was like, this is like, I thought it was absurd, to be honest with you. I just walked right or ran right by it. But, you know, now I'm thinking back, well, I was the one who should have started taking that snow cone instead. But that's actually, it's really cool to hear that. And I mean, I guess typically you look back at, when we look at the history of triathlon, you just kind of see, you know, the guys. I mean, people still do it today, but I know Maca, Chris McCormick was well known. He always had a sponge with him, or I know a lot of athletes still do that too. But I mean, taking it to the next level and using things like slushies, snow cones, and ice, I think that's kind of the better way of going now as we look at Ironmans these days in the heat.
Plus you don't get the finish line photos of sponges down your jacket. Still bug him about that.
That's awesome.
Instead, you'll have the blue dye from the slushy on your face.
Oh, good point.
That's hilarious.
Good luck.
No, yeah, but that's the march of progress, right? Like the more we understand these things, and sometimes they're, you know, probably ice wasn't available at
at a certain point because people didn't think much of it. You know, when if you look at cycling 100 years ago, they were drinking red wine and beer. and so
while smoking cigarettes.
To open up the lungs, right? So as people understand these things better and as they become more normal and maybe as probably the pros driving this process as they ask for these things, then the effect is trickled down to age groupers too, so that we can benefit from all of their suffering and experience.
Yeah, definitely. And there's definitely been a ton of innovation over the years, especially, you know, Ironman triathlon is still a fairly young sport. We've seen things move pretty quickly, but what do you guys think? What are kind of the biggest innovations we've seen in recent years when it comes to racing and triathlon?
Ooh.
Easy question,
Michael,
right?
Yeah. How much time do we have? Yeah.
Well, so it depends on your, I think it depends on your time window. I think the, you know, you, if you, you want to look at technology, certainly the bikes have evolved. That's probably the more obvious answer. If you look back at, you know, at the early stages of that sport, the guys were racing road bikes, and now they're racing carbon fiber, you know, speed rockets with integrated everything and disc brakes. So there's obvious, you know, aerodynamic benefits there. And that's sort of where, you know, our expertise is. You know, on the training side of things, people now understand a little bit better what it takes to tolerate those kind of distances and sort of how to most efficiently work with the human physiology to get the most out of our performance over that kind of duration. Because, you know, sure, humans are very, very purpose built for endurance sport. And that's something we've been doing for, you know, hundreds of thousands of years. But to do it at such a high level for so many hours, this is something that's relatively new.
Yeah, no, that's so true. And so actually, when you talk about that and you talk about innovation, one of the things that stands out in my mind is nutrition when it comes to, you know, flashback 25, 30 years ago. I still remember watching, I can't remember the documentary that I was watching, but there was something about the pros back there. I guess some of the people who just started the triathlon series, they were having on these long rides, like they would stop and have a Big Mac or like a burger or something really greasy. And that they just kind of thought that's what you need to, on these long rides, following a marathon to follow after. Like they just thought, you know, taking as much as you can, and it didn't really matter to them what it was. And now we've gotten so advanced with nutrition hydration strategies that you can almost pinpoint based off your sweat rate and the type of environment you're going to be in that what exactly. Actually, perfect example, your guys' podcast on metabolism. I don't know if you could briefly sort of run people through all that. And I know it's a long topic, but you know, just how that kind of works in with your nutrition and hydration strategies for Ironmans these days.
It's certainly long, but it's also really controversial. It's kind of fun because I'll throw my cards out on the table. I'm firmly in the carbohydrate for fueling camp, rather than, you know, the low carb, high fat or keto folks. And you know, I won't sling too much mud today, but you can listen to my metabolism to that metabolism rant that I did on our episode. So there's a very kind of very, very high level. If you're using carbohydrates for fueling, and that can be really any source of carbs you like, your body is just more efficient at creating the molecule that makes you go, that ATP molecule that actually facilitates the muscle contraction. It's your body's more efficient at producing those ATP molecules from carbohydrate than it is from fat. And by efficient, I mean you get more of them for the same amount of oxygen. So fat for fuel is obviously essential and we all do it. And for a long course, it is a big win to be able to use as much fat for fuel as possible. But the thing to understand is that even the leanest athlete, and I've heard Lionel talk about the fact that at some point he was something like 5 or 6% body fat, which is, you know, mind-bogglingly low. Even a 5% body fat Lionel Sanders has enough endogenous or like stored fat to fuel him for several Ironman races. So no one is going to be limited by their stored fat reserves, but in a long course race, everyone is limited by their stored glycogen reserves. And glycogen is the, you know, the readily available carbohydrate store for animals and obviously humans. So being able to use carbs for fuel as efficiently as possible, as well as fat for fuel is essential. And then, but in order to be able to use those carbs for fuel, you need to be practicing fueling with carbohydrates. So on, you know, especially racing simulation workouts or high intensity work, carbs are essential to make you go. And obviously on race day as well.
I have almost a periodized kind of way of eating when I'm training in the off season. It's a lot more kind of in my day-to-day diet, higher fat, lower carb, definitely not keto or low carb overall. But then as the season progresses and the intensity of some of the rides and runs come up, and then of course, when you're doing more kind of race simulation workouts, that's when it's definitely a lot higher carb during the training fueling. But I stay fairly consistently that lower carb, not low carb, higher fat diet. And then race day, it's just as many carbs as you can take on, because like you mentioned, that's what your body is going to run out of first. And that's what kind of keeps you going over, you know, an 8 to 17 hour day.
Yeah, for sure. And I think there's good evidence for to support what you're doing. And a lot of folks are starting to think about periodizing carbohydrate use. And I think that's the smart way to go. because there is, you know, there's some benefits to lower carb diets. You know, generally it's body composition stuff, right? Which we all kind of all want for aesthetic reasons and also for performance reasons. But the fact that you're using carbs for fueling, especially of your workouts, I think that's the key component. Yeah. And this is something that, you know, I often hear from the LCHF, that's the low carb, high fat folks, or the keto, well, not so much the keto folks, but they say, well, we still race with carbohydrates. You know, we don't ever train with carbs, but we race with carbs. And the problem with that is, just like anything in our bodies, we become used to something or other. So if you're consistently depriving your body of carbohydrate, which is, you know, a high crime in my opinion, mostly because I really like carbs, not because this is just trying
agreed
to be funny. But yeah, anyway, so if you're constantly fueling your workouts with you know, with fat and not having a lot of free carbohydrates, then your body becomes less good at at processing carbs. Simple as
absolutely
that. So the enzymes that facilitate the breakdown of all of that stuff, and the transport enzymes that allow carbohydrates to enter the cytoplasm of the cell for that glycolytic metabolism to kick everything off, those transport proteins just aren't as there aren't as many of them, right? So that the flow of carbs into the cytoplasm, that the inside of the muscle cell, is now slower. So your ability to use carbs for fuel now is degraded. So whenever they've done the studies that I've seen, they say, oh yes, absolutely, if you restrict carbs, your athlete becomes more fat adapted, and everyone goes hooray. But then the cost of that is that they become less well carb adapted. So if they have to do any kind of work near threshold or above threshold, that performance declines precipitously. And also for really demanding racing, when you do wring every last ounce of strength out of your body, you can't do it as well if you don't have that ability to ingest, digest, and use carbohydrates.
Boiling it down to a simple philosophy, I'm just a fan of train like you race. And if you're not used to training with it, you're not going to race well with it.
Yeah, excellent point.
Along the lines of nothing new race day.
I seem to have not learned that just yet. I always preach it, but then when it comes down to race day, I'm always finding something new last second, but I'm guilty for that. But no, so anyway, so, you know, diving into this nutrition a little bit more before we kind of switch the topic on, I just kind of wanted to ask and kind of get the whole consensus of everyone's opinion on this, touching on a few principles on race day. So when it comes to, perfect example, let's talk about the Ironman distance, and I guess more specifically Kona, what sort of strategies or principles should we be adapting in our on-course nutrition plan? Things like, is there a baseline that we start out with for fluid levels, and same with sodium, electrolytes, and carbs, things like that? Do you guys have any take on that?
Ooh, that's a tough one. I guess I kind of mentioned my strategy before. So I have an idea of the amount of carbs I want to get in. For me, it's usually 60 to 70 grams an hour. I find I do well with. But at the end of the day, it's just kind of how your stomach absorbs it. So if I can take on a little bit more, I do. If it's starting to feel kind of full and bloated, I'll take a little bit more water to let it settle. But you can set all the plans you want, but you need to take the time to actually test it in, like you said, those kind of long training workouts, those race specific workouts, to see what works specifically for you. I'm probably on the lower side of kind of electrolyte intake, more thoughts along kind of the Tim Noakes side of things, because I've done some like crazy hot training with little lower in electrolyte intake, and that works for me. But it is all so individual. It's something you definitely have to test pre-race day.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with pretty much everything you just said, Jenna. The sort of the guidelines that I will, speak with my athletes about and encourage is we start with very general rules. Like, this is kind of the maximal carbohydrate intake that most people can tolerate. This is generally thought to be the maximum fluid that you can absorb. We try to overtrain over the time that we're training, maximize the their ability to take in the fluid and take in the carbs. Carbs are, I think, Jenna, you made this point earlier that when it's hot, or maybe Andrew made this point, when it's hot, mm-hmm. You have obviously more of your body's resources, the blood used to cool yourself, and less available for digestion. So in hot conditions, our ability to process carbohydrates or anything really is lower. One thing I would say is that even people who in long course would eat something other than carbohydrate, and this does happen sometimes, mostly for that feeling of fullness, I think sometimes people will eat bars. And this in a hot race, I think that's even more problematic than in any other race. So I would steer folks clear of solid foods. I think solid foods are not for hot, humid races. But otherwise, still keeping carbs fairly unchanged from their, from what we've practiced in training. In terms of hydration is pretty tricky. So Jenna, you were saying that you tend to be low sodium intake, and that is, in what I've read, I think you're right that there's a ton of inter-individual variability, and there are people who have, sodium concentrations in their sweat that are very low, and others that are very high. And I think I hope I'm not misquoting this, but I think the swing can be three times. And by that, I mean, somebody who is a very salty sweater, the sodium concentration in their sweat can be three times that of somebody who is not a salty sweater. And most of that is genetic. So the fact that you say that you're a low sodium sweater, that could very well be. That could just be that your genetics, mean that you don't lose a lot of sodium in your sweat.
Mm-hmm, definitely. Yeah, I always get to test in the training beforehand. Although I will mention one thing that I do on race day that I never do in training is Coke and water the back half of the run, any distance. Seems to be the magic fuel in there. Just fast, easily absorb carbs and caffeine.
For sure. Caffeine's awesome. Coke is cool, but Coke, if you started a little bit too soon for a lot of people, because it's so concentrated, it's just basically like a glucose and water solution. And like, caramel color and dyes and stuff, obviously.
All that fun stuff.
All that fun stuff, the stuff that clears your drain clogs. You can get serious GI issues because it's so concentrated that what ends up happening is you end up pulling fluid into the gut rather than going the other way, right? So the term is osmolality. Like it's so concentrated, mm-hmm. Coke is, that it actually pulls fluid into your digestive tract, and then you end up spending some time at the porta potties.
Yeah, that's never good. I find usually the last 10K is a good time for it. But if you start it, you just can't stop taking it. It's a very fast burning fuel, and then you can bonk pretty quickly if you don't keep on it.
Perfect. Sure. No, good, guys. That's awesome. Some great great piece of information there as far as nutrition goes, and especially pertaining to Kona as well. So I think that's a lot of good advice for a lot of listeners here. And, you know, just switching up a little bit, and I know this is definitely your guys' forte here, talking about bike positioning and virtual wind tunnel. Because again, as we mentioned earlier, both Jen and I had our bike fits done by both you guys, and we each had our test done on the virtual wind tunnel. So I guess let's sort of narrow in, just for the sake of today's episode, let's narrow in on Jenna's results. They're the most recent ones and fitting because it's made some big changes for you leading into Kona, eh, Jenna?
Yeah, definitely. And it was really, Andrew, it was really interesting to talk with you kind of before and after the testing to analyze those results a little further. But I found it was a much different test than I expected for it, kind of from the snapshots of results I had seen. I thought maybe you're changing positions throughout the test, but it's so simple because you essentially sit in your race position and they go around you with an iPad and a scanner, taking a look at what that looks at. And then Andrew actually takes that information and starts to play around with your position to see what would be more aerodynamic, what would be beneficial. And for my test, what I saw in there was it would probably make me a little bit faster if I was a little farther out in the front, so where my reach was, where my elbows were moving a little bit farther, and then if I was able to get a little bit lower in there as well. So that position wasn't something that was really possible with my current bike setup with the longer cranks that I had on beforehand. Just it would reduce my hip angle too much for me to be able to run effectively off of that. So I ended up taking the virtual wind tunnel results and taking it to my bike fitter to kind of see, play around what would be something that we could kind of, what changes would be realistic for me. And one of the things we had been talking about beforehand was actually changing to shorter cranks, just for the reason where I would be able to get a little bit more aggressive, at the same time still have a wider hip angle. So this report kind of just cemented that idea a little bit more, showing that, yeah, if we did the shorter cranks, that position's very achievable for me. It wouldn't be exactly the wind tunnel or virtual wind tunnel recommendations, but it would kind of achieve the same idea. So it was cool to be able to take those results, take some of the recommendations, and see what changes I could actually work out with my bike fitter to kind of move into that direction to hopefully gain a little bit of free speed, be a little bit faster, and I was actually able to find a position that's more comfortable and at the same time should be theoretically more aerodynamic and pretty aggressive. So it was really, really cool to see that.
Yeah, so it's interesting the point you made about it being almost too simple when yeah. you actually get the scan done. So I should probably add some additional steps just to make it seem like we're doing more. but yeah, in all seriousness, though, it's super easy once we get the initial scan. We do all the changes offline. So it's something that you could even call us up. And with your model that we already have, we could swap out helmets. We could start changing certain things. And you could even explore some additional results without even having to be there. So it makes it super flexible. We can swap in and out a ton of things. And we're just basically looking at expanding the process right now so that we can take even more into account and have better correlated results. But in general, we've had a lot of great feedback from some of the pros that we've worked with, a lot of time trialists specifically in Norway. We've got a really good partner there who's been sending us a ton of pro athletes. So, but yeah, coming off the virtual wind tunnel results, they've all been saying, you know, they're getting personal bests and things like that. So great feedback on the service. But the other point you touched on was the shorter cranks. And I am a huge fan of those.
Everybody on 165, everybody. I don't care how tall you are, the shortest cranks you can buy that'll fit your bike, everybody on the shortest cranks possible. Yep. Sorry, Andrew.
Yeah, that pretty much sums it up, though. Because, like Michael, you and I are both pretty tall. I ride 165s. Yep, it's not too. Like it correlates to your height. If anything, it's maybe opposite sometimes. But yeah, I'm a big fan of the shorter cranks. It lets you get your torso in a more aggressive position. Obviously, there's going to be some flexibility limitations. So if you can't get your back flat anyway, regardless of the crank length, then shorter cranks aren't going to help. But it does open up a lot more possibilities when people are looking for that extra aerodynamic edge. But for yourself, for a hot, long race like Kona, comfort has to be number one, because you're not going fast if you're sitting up on your base bar. So I think everyone can agree on that. So the last thing that we want to do is put you in a position that's really uncomfortable, or give you equipment that's really hot, like a full aero helmet that's shrouded and has no cooling.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And one thing that I found really fascinating was when I came and visited you guys after getting the virtual wind tunnel testing, was you pulled up a spreadsheet in there of kind of the results and information, and I told you like my exact weight, and you were able to kind of see what my speed should be over a 70.3, and it correlated almost exactly with the speed I had just done at Calgary, 70.3. So it was just cool to see how specific and how accurate those numbers are from the virtual wind tunnel.
Yeah, and it's always great to get feedback like that, because we're kind of putting the information out into a void. We don't have any, like, we're getting a scan of someone and we have to, not guess, but we have to rely on the information that we have. And every time I hear this, these kind of stories where, you know, it correlated to a previous race result, like, that's fantastic for me to hear. And it gives me more confidence in the service and the recommendations I give to people.
Yeah, definitely. And like the coolest thing I think about it is just how you guys do have that kind of library of equipment and different things that you can swap out to see what would make people more aerodynamic without them actually having to go out and buy a $500-$600 plus helmet to test it out to see if maybe this will work or not. You guys have that all that information there to do it virtually.
Well, that's one of the big limitations with a lot of the other testing. Like, even if you have the resources to go to a wind tunnel or have a connection that, say, you get free wind tunnel time, like, you've still got to have the equipment to test. So if you want to adjust the stack height or something like that, you need all the spacers, which are often, especially in the superbikes, are often expensive and proprietary. Plus, if you're spending 45 minutes changing a position, you're still paying that $1,000 an hour for the wind tunnel. They don't care if you're changing your bike or running the wind tunnel. Like, you're going to be paying that regardless. So all these changes we make, it's done offline while you're, you know, driving to work or sleeping or doing whatever. So that's the real benefit of it, is it doesn't tie up your time at all.
Yeah, no, it was such a cool experience, and it was definitely fun to take that information back to my bike fitter. And you know, it was one of those things that prompted some changes that we were thinking about making and working towards. And honestly, I found a position now that I can just sit in all day, but should be faster too, which is a combination you don't often find, but I'm pretty excited about it for Kona.
Excellent. And I'm definitely looking forward to hearing how it works out.
Oh,
in fact,
wait.
I'll be there so I can
cheer
you on.
There we go. Yeah.
So, you know, it's funny because we look at a little bit of a different story there. So now, Mike, I don't know if you can remember, it's quite a while ago when we did mine, but a little bit of a backstory. I came in pretty much like a hot mess there. So I came in with a bike that was
suboptimal, Stephen.
There you go.
Yeah. So kind of picture like a piece of plywood sitting on a bike. That's kind of where I was in terms of aerodynamics. So before going there, actually, I had a couple bike fits, and they were quite expensive, but rule of thumb is when I went to a local shop, let's say, and they just were not equipped to, you know, fit for a triathlon specific bike. So there was, you know, I paid for the fit. We adjusted some things, and now we actually adjusted from a 175 crank, which is crazy, down to 170. But now after hearing you guys talk about 165, I kind of regret that decision of only going to 170, but we, you know what, the bike fit I had before that, it wasn't ideal. There was no aerodynamic, you know, benefits to it at all. So when I went to see Mike and we did the virtual wind tunnel, before we even started, he's like, we have to do some adjustments here, because he's like, this just isn't really practical. So we made quite substantial adjustments and actually worked out really well. So just within, I don't know how long that took, not long, but we really changed a lot of, he actually became my bike fitter at the same day we did the virtual wind tunnel. So it was a pretty cool story. And then actually the results came in and they were pretty good. I mean, there were no like Jackson Laundry or Cody Beals, but you know, I was surprised to see how, you know, the numerical values behind the virtual wind tunnel and how much it made improvements in the race leading after. So it was pretty cool.
You came in and then I think we talked a little bit about it and I explained the service and you wanted a baseline number. And then I remember you saying that you were having some comfort issues in your current position. So just kind of eyeballing it, it didn't look amazing. And so we tried a couple of things and I remember you telling me that it felt more comfortable. And then if you're telling me it feels more comfortable and just from experience, kind of like, you know, the slow twitch wind tunnel where you kind of like, is this more aero or is this more aero? We did a little bit of that. And then when I asked Andrew to run the numbers for you, we ran the position that was the most comfortable for you. And the slow twitch way was the fastest. And then compare it to your original position, which I had jotted down. And there was a pretty big difference between the two, as I remember. I'm actually just trying to find your report and I don't have it at my fingertips, but I remember the number being quite substantially different.
Yeah, no, it was pretty fascinating. So after that, I became obviously a huge fan of the virtual wind tunnel, but that actually kind of brought up another question here. And I actually been asked a couple times when it comes the virtual wind tunnel analysis and same with bike fitting as well too. How often should athletes be, you know, getting checked? Because I assume flexibility changes and just postural changes overall that might change your bike fitting, and also virtual wind tunnel analysis. Is there, you know, better times to repeat it going forward, like an annual thing, or what are your thoughts on that?
Well, what I think is best is actually doing it in the fall, which seems counterintuitive, but the reason I like that is because it gives you a chance to adapt to a new position over the winter. So if you're going to be spending long hours training, in addition to training your cardiovascular system, you might as well train your muscles a little bit to adapt to a new position. So you don't want to reteach them something in the spring when you go out and ride for the first time, because you're just going to be sore and uncomfortable, and then your first race is going to come up and you're going to be disappointed. But I think you should really take a look at it, you know, in the fall or anytime there's a large change, or say you start a new training regime where you're working on flexibility or strength or something like that. But not even from the standpoint of pushing a service, but just from a general outlook, I think, you know, the more often you look at it or the more often you keep an eye on things, the better off you'll be as an athlete.
I agree with you, what you said, Andrew. I think, It's my pet phrase now. It's a multivariate problem. There's a lot of things at play. And we've talked about this on a number of occasions already. The point that sitting up, you're going to be slower than even a pretty poor aero position. So I err on the side of comfort too, especially for, you know, for folks racing long. So if there is, you know, a minute difference in aerodynamics and a noticeable difference in comfort in the, you know, 30, 40 minutes that or an hour that we spend doing virtual wind tunnel fit or virtual wind tunnel analysis, then I err on the side of let's try to go a little bit less aggressive. Because sometimes the numbers aren't that remarkably different. I actually found, I found Steven's report, and then from the original position to the new and improved position, he went from a 0.263 CDA to a 0.246. And Andrew, I'm going to put you on the spot because I like doing this. I don't have to because I have the numbers. So,
I've got it in back. Front of me too. So I was going to try and be really smart.
Sound like you know it off the cuff.
Yeah. So I think you've got your deltas or your differences in race time. So, between the slowest and the fastest position that we tested for Steven at 200 watts over an Ironman, you were looking at around 220 seconds, which is, you know, just under 4 minutes difference on the bike. So that's certainly not nothing, but it's not a huge amount of time. But between some of the positions that were very, very close, because, you know, there was the position you came in with, which was not very aerodynamic, but then we tried a few different things which tested quite closely together. And the differences between those were seconds.
Perfect. Yeah.
You know, they were like within like 30 seconds of each other, which is, or less, which is, I would say at that point, it's a, you know, it's so much in the margin of error that it's not even worth calling them different positions. So then the difference between, for me, unless you're Alan Hovda, who wants to be the most aerodynamic athlete in the world,
If you're not Alan, for 99.999% of us, I would say, you know, take comfort over a very small difference in aerodynamics. So that's just another point I want to add.
Definitely. Yeah. And when you're talking about changing that, I definitely agree, changing your bike position, if you're going to do it the fall, is the best time to go after it. With the caveat that if you're going to be stuck with a lot of indoor training, ride in your aero position in that indoor training. I see so many people
100%. Yeah,
see so many people get the fit and get ready for race season on their aero bike, TT bike, but the whole winter they're sitting up on their bars and not actually training the muscles that they'll be racing with.
So here's something interesting that I've just thought of kind of recently, but if you're sitting in front of a TV, like Netflix, I'm sure is what a lot of people watch while they're doing training on, you know, Trainer Road or something like that. If you put the TV kind of underneath you where you'd normally be looking, then it encourages you to be.
That's exactly where I have mine. Mine's like 2 feet off the ground, so I look at it.
That's smart.
Yeah, just put a clear garbage bag over it so all the sweat dripping off doesn't.
That's way to set up your environment to, you know, suit your, you know, what you, the habit that you're trying to form, Andrew. That's very, very evolved of you.
That's good. So actually, so one point here, and this has been a common debate. Now I want to get you guys take on all this. So when we're talking about staying in the air position as long as you can, because the second we, you know, get out of that air position, we start just losing a lot of precious time. So when it comes to hill climbs, now I guess it all depends on the gradient changes, but at what point do you guys think it'd be more beneficial to on a steep hill climb? Is it get out of that air position and just focus on the climb, or what's the whole take on that?
Well, do you want to take a shot at this first, Michael? I've got kind of my canned answer that I've done a few times, but I'm just curious what your opinion is.
I think we're on the same page. So I will actually let you answer, but I do want to kind of interject something about what sort of related to what Stephen asked. So when we do say you want to be an aero as much as possible, this is true, but some people get completely absurd with what I just said. So, you know, with the, you know, the type A triathletes, if your Ironman bike leg is, you know, super, if you're crazy fast, it's just north of 4 hours, but for the rest of us, it's somewhere between 5 and 6 and 7 hours. That's a long time. Right. So if you sit up, let's say you need to scratch your ass, or you need to take a drink, or you need to stretch your back because it's getting sore, and you're out of aero for 20 seconds, 20 seconds out of those 6 hours is nothing. It's again in that measurement error. It's a completely inconsequential amount of time. And yes, your drag goes up. So either you slow down marginally over those 20 seconds, or you have to put out a little bit more power to keep your speed over the 20 seconds, which is likely what's going to happen. Cause you know, you're, unless you're shifting gears and your cadence doesn't change, chances are your speed is going to not change, but your power may go up a little bit cause you're pushing a little bit more air out of the way. But if you're out there for 20 seconds doing your thing, like filling your bottle or whatever, then you go back into aero and you're cool. That's, in my book, that's the way to do it. Especially if, you know, you need to kind of stretch. You need to stretch periodically. So doing those proactive micro stretches in the middle of your ride, that is, I think, a very smart thing to do. Because then the opposite case scenario is if you're sucking it up, and then, you know, hour three rolls around and you can't maintain it any longer, and you really have to sit up for like 20 minutes in order to get rid of that kink in your back, then you're really paying the price. So this is something that I think people misunderstand a little bit. The cost of sitting up, is high provided you're sitting up for a long period of time. If you sit up for a tiny fraction of your race, then that cost is very, very, very low and could be the smart thing to do. So, you know, especially if it has anything to do with hydration or nutrition, I've heard this happen, that people won't drink or eat because they're trying to be more aero, which I think is totally ludicrous. Where they'll be more reluctant to eat or drink because they don't want to break aero. And that's crazy town. And Andrew, do you want to talk about hills now?
Yeah, good answer. As far as hills go, the number that I've gone back and forth with is generally like 18 to 20 kilometers an hour is where the argument I make it would be, if you're putting out 10% more power on a hill, that would kind of be the crossover for the 10% more power offsetting the aerodynamic loss. So really that's a lot slower than people think. So you're actually gaining quite a bit staying in an aero position, for quite a while on the hill, but like Michael said, if it's something that will benefit you later in the race because you can stretch out a little bit, then definitely take advantage of that. You're not going to lose as much on a hill as you would on a flat spot. So if it comes to sitting up, downhill would be the worst place to do it. Flats would be pretty bad. And then uphill is the best. So take advantage of it while you can, considering that it's not the fastest bike split that wins a race. It's the fastest overall time. So you want to be in good shape for the run and not arrive with a kink in your back or cramps or something like that because you didn't stretch out properly during the bike. I think that's the answer that I generally go with. But one thing that I want to kind of put in here is maybe food for thought more than anything else is, we did an analysis on drafting a while back, and not illegal drafting, but like slingshotting for a pass, which you can't do as a pro, but you can do as an age grouper. And I think we found that, in this scenario, if you were to pass like maybe 500 athletes, you gain about 10 minutes on your overall time by legally drafting from everyone else.
Interesting.
It's a crazy large effect.
It blew me away when Andrew came back with these numbers because, and I'll tell the anecdote in a minute, but yeah, it was a crazy effect.
So what you'd be better off doing potentially is with the Kona isn't this way, with all the other races that have the self-seated starts, if you kind of sandbag and start at the back, swim through some of the pack, but then have a whole bunch of riders to pass. Yeah, it might be a little more crowded, but you're going to be getting a slingshot almost constantly.
Be me with an average swim and a strong bike leg. I yell on the left more than I'd like to, but that's good to know.
Yeah, that's exactly where my question came from. This was one of the first episodes we recorded because this was my question for Andrew was how much do I gain by this? Because I'm a mid pack swimmer and much better than mid pack cyclist, and I have that effect all the time. And the thing that I've noticed is I'm a big nerd, as you may have noticed, and so I'll actually go back and after the fact model my races and look sort of at what my effective CDA, what my effective aerodynamics were in the race. So I look at power versus speed, essentially, especially if it's a race I've done before. And I noticed that in races, my CDA was crazy low. Like it would be much lower than what Andrew and I had tested. And it would be much lower than what I would have done, say, on a solo time trial. And I couldn't figure out what the difference was. And the thing that I thought about, and Andrew's analysis bore it out, was the fact that I was legally passing all these people. So, if you're like Jenna or myself, I guess, and you're not a pro and you're allowed to do this, what you do is you have your draft zone, which depending on the race you're doing, but typically it's 12 meters that you're not allowed to be in unless you're drafting. So you have a certain amount of time to clear that draft zone. But in that amount of time, you are legally allowed to draft the person in front of you until, you pass them. So if there are enough folks that you end up passing, you can get very substantial time.
Yeah.
Crazy.
That's going to make me reconsider. Yeah.
Yeah. Which sucks. Which sucks if you're a strong swimmer and not such a strong cyclist. I don't have a lot of pity for you, but if you're an average swimmer and good on the bike, then you get a little bit of a legal win there.
Yeah, it won't happen too much in Kona, I'm sure, though, with the fast swimmers, but they can all bike and run too.
Yeah, Kona's a little bit different like that.
Yeah. No, that's good. So, just one of these last questions I had in mind, and I don't want this to be, it's going to be a pretty broad question, so hopefully you guys can try and narrow it in a little bit more. But, with everyone kind of listening in and hearing about the virtual wind tunnel and the bike fitting that we were all talking about, when it comes to common issues you find, amongst typical age groupers out there, when they come to you guys, what are some of these common bike, you can even use me for a perfect example, but like some of these corrections that you guys see needed for, bike fitting, is there something common around age groups, age group triathletes that you typically find?
I would say head position is probably the number one aerodynamic crime. And I think we kind of coined that term.
Pending, yep.
So what was the other one? It was frame mounted bottles. Not a fan of those. So if you can mount it behind the saddle, that's definitely the best way to go. What else was there? yeah, just head and hand position really is what I think most of the gains can be summed up as.
Hand position.
Yeah, from a bike fitting perspective, and you were the prime example, Stephen, and you probably represent 80% of the population. When people get their bikes and they first get their bikes fitted, they often go to their local bike shop. And more often than not, bike shops are quite used to fitting road bikes and have no idea how to fit time trial bikes. No clue whatsoever. And even if they do, they might be fitting them for UCI time trial, which is a totally different ball of wax because they have very strict rules to follow in the way that the geometry of the bike and where the saddle needs to be and where the bars need to be, which are completely irrelevant in triathlon just because our rule books don't have them.
I would even make the argument they're unsafe in some cases. I know Nate Pearson from Trainer Road, he has his anecdote about because of his height, he can't put his extensions in a position that's actually safe for him to ride and still be UCI legal.
Oh, yeah, UCI rules were written for 5'6" Italians who weigh 110 pounds.
Yeah.
And we're smoking and drinking red wine.
Yes. Right. Yeah, of course. You have the wine bottle holder between the aero bars.
And it makes such a huge difference in there. Like, I know I don't have the highest power on the bike, but I was fortunate enough to find a good bike fitter early on in triathlon who kind of showed me what a good position was, but gave me a plan to progress to an even faster position over a couple seasons. And it makes a huge difference when you're not just wasting energy in a terrible bike position.
Yeah, absolutely. So that initial position, when you're, for if you're an age grouper, especially if you're just starting out, especially if it's your first triathlon bike fit, find somebody who knows what they're doing in triathlon specific fits. So that would be good places to start would be, you can always talk to your local clubs and see who does the fits. So now there are shops that will sell TT bikes, but they don't know how to fit them properly. But there are other, in some of the bigger markets, there are shops that are triathlon specific. So those tend to have bike fitters who have a little bit more knowledge. So that is a big deal. I really like Andrew's point about head position, because this is something that people never think about, because they look straight ahead and they look at the horizon and their head is just like a giant giant air speed bump, punching a much bigger hole than they need to. And often that actually requires a little bit of training too, being able to hold a low head position and still be comfortable with how much or how little road you're going to see. that's probably the easiest win. I agree with him there.
So a really interesting example of the head position is if you want to go back and watch the race coverage from 2018 Mont Tremblant with Cody Beals. I remember, because I was talking to him a bunch about this before the race, but he had his head really low, but he would basically peek up. It was kind of like a whack-a-mole situation where he'd peek up just enough to see the road and then pop his head down for a few seconds, and then peek up just enough to see it and then pop his head down. And that's not a terrible strategy because you can see where you're going and you maintain most of that aerodynamic advantage.
Wow. Yeah, no, that's actually real interesting. Yeah, and I guess that's a lot of the dilemma, I guess, where a lot of age groupers look at is when you watch a pro coverage, you see the positions they go into. So a lot of age groupers might think when they go get their first bike fit that they want to be that aero, right? And so as Mike and I kind of realized that we could have went more, lower on the front end, but we opted out to, go a little less aggressive to just kind of ease into things and kind of make it more comfortable, right? So it doesn't always have to match what the pros are doing in the front pack of the Ironman. So just a little good piece of advice for everyone to know about.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's so many elements to your position, but there's some things that really, pedaling from a narrow hip angle, Jenna talked about, and the whole point of having shorter crank arms is to get a greater hip angle. But I've seen folks, especially if you look at, again, UCI time trialists who have to have a really far saddle position because of, again, UCI rules. They pedal from a super tight hip angle at the top of the pedal stroke, and they can still generate you know, absurd wattage from that position because they've trained in it and they have really, you know, exceptional physiologies. But most of us don't, especially most of us who sit and have tight hip flexors and kind of dead bums. It's tough to generate power at the top of the pedal stroke. Not that you're going to get a ton of power from there anyway, but that causes, you know, having somebody sit too low on the front end and have that hip angle be super tight can be a problem. And Jenna mentioned, you know, you might not run very well off the bike if you're doing that, and that's mm-hmm. a common problem. So yeah, I agree with you, Stephen, that it would be a mistake to chase that exact position of a pro, even if you, even if in the 15 minute or 30 minute session of a virtual wind tunnel scan, you feel like you could hold that position. It's a different meatball when you're out there for, you know, 6-7 hours of an Ironman bike leg.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you know what, guys, I mean, I think that's a great spot to end off the episode. I think we covered a lot of topics there, and I think that'd give enough time for people to kind of digest everything that we just talked about there. So a lot of great insight. And of course, I think we keep going all day. But you know what? Let's just say that's a wrap there. So I think that was excellent.
Yeah. Thanks so much for coming on, guys. It was a lot of fun to chat and geek out a little bit. So for the Pacing and Racing listeners, if they want to tune into your podcast, where can they find it?
Well, the classic line for podcast listeners is wherever you find your podcast.
so true.
Yeah. Yeah, we're on all of the kind of the major services, Google and Apple Podcasts and iTunes and Spotify. And if you just look for Endurance Innovation, you will find us there.
Perfect.
And sounds good.
You guys have social media as well, Instagram, Facebook, all that?
Actually, no. Well, I mean, Four Eyes. So I think it's, I should have known this before.
I think it's 4iicom.
So the way we've been told by HR to say this is the number 4 followed by I, then com for the social media stuff. But yeah, you would maybe not be surprised by the number of issues we've had with our emails not making it through because of...
when too few eyes or too many eyes.
Yes.
That's hilarious.
And I'm at X3 Training for Facebook and Instagram. So letter X, number 3 training. You can find me there. I usually talk about the kind of stuff I've been talking about with you guys for the last hour and a bit, about, you know, technology, physiology, coaching. That's sort of my bread and butter at X3.
Cool. And actually, so it's funny, I was just emailing with David Tilbury Davis, and we're just talking about coaching and all that kind of stuff. And he actually gave you a big kudos on your coaching. So just for other listeners to hear that, he actually said you guys are quite like-minded and share similar philosophies. So I was like, that's actually really cool. I got to make sure I mentioned that to him. So there you go. You got kudos from David Tilbury Davis. So that's pretty big.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, that's. I mean, hey, that's as high praise as it gets in the coaching world, I think. I've got to send him a thank you email and thank you for that. Yeah, David and I have been working for a little while. Just on the coaching side of things, he's been my coaching mentor for the last, I think, 2.5 years. Where we chat about that kind of stuff. So some of the data and the information that I've been talking about today is sort of parroting what David has told me over the years.
Awesome. No, that's very cool, guys. Anyway, thanks so much, guys, for coming on, and we'll talk to you guys next time.
Yeah, thanks a lot. It was a ton of fun.
Yeah, thanks for having us on, for sure.
Well, I hope you guys all enjoyed this podcast. There's some incredible insight from multiple perspectives, so I hope you had a lot of takeaways from this and hope you had as much fun as we did. So if you guys did like this episode, please take 2 minutes to leave a kind review on the podcast channel, as this helps us get heard by more listeners through the podcast platform algorithms. And lastly, if you did want to find us on social media, you can find us on Instagram at pacing.an.racing, and you can find Jenna by searching at Jenna Sayer, and that is C-A-E-R.